Hey, welcome to the podcast big show today. We talk to all of the people who are actually involved in some of the biggest debates of our time. Brexit, we had Daniel Hannan on, who was fascinating, a wee bit frightening towards the end, I thought. But you can be a judge.
But he's frightening with an English accent, so it feels a lot better.
Yeah. Well, you know it's more credible.
Right.
Because he said it with an English accent. Also, a member of the Russian LGBT network. Why is it we're not hearing about this from the mainstream media? We don't even know her name because she fears for her life in Russia. And the border issue, a powerful, powerful interview with Laura Wilkerson.
Yeah, her son was murdered by an illegal immigrant.
Tortured
a dreamer, actually.
Yeah.
A dreamer. And we get into the details of that. It's tough to listen to, but it's important to listen to. Also, we had Matt Kibbe on, who, I'll break the news to you, announcing a brand new show on Blaze TV, as well as going over the news of the day. You can watch Matt's show coming up on Blaze TV at blazetv.com/Beck. Use the promo code Beck and get $10 off. I'll also tell you tomorrow, the debut of Steven Crowder. Louder with Crowder comes back for a new season on Blaze TV. It's a big week here at Blaze TV.
Now, time for the podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Home Title Lock, our sponsor. Home Title Lock is something that both Stu and I have, and we all got it. Pat has it too. We all got it separately because we all kind of talked to this sponsor. We're like, holy cow. And so each of us signed up for it and then told the other one, boy, have you seen this yet? This is something that I can't believe nobody is watching. The title of your home, especially if you have parents who have paid off their home, there's a good chance somebody can go in and steal that. It's really, really simple, and only one company is watching those titles to make sure that you don't become a victim.
Yeah, Home Title Lock. If you have equity, you're a big target. If you're the ones doing it right and paying your house off, you're the target. HomeTitleLock.com is the place to go. They have a free title scan to see if anything's happened to you so far. It is free, $100 value, free when you sign up at HomeTitleLock.com. It's HomeTitleLock.com.
So let's see. Here's the story from places like the Huffington Post. The Democratic National Committee is no longer sponsoring the annual Women March. It's set to take place on Saturday in Washington, D.C. The Women's March co-presidents, Tamika Mallory and Bob Bland, appeared on The View Monday, where the show's co-host peppered them with questions about the organization. Mallory's relationship with Farrakhan was put on the front burner in a heated segment, where she refused to denounce him and instead called him one of the greatest of all time for what he's done in the black communities. She repeated to refuse to condemn Farrakhan's remarks about Jewish people and others, even though being pressured to do so. Women's March had been under scrutiny for allegations of anti-sexism, sexism, and more. As pointed out by the Daily Beast, the DNC was listed among the organization's sponsors as recently as Sunday. As of last night, they are no longer listed as a sponsor. Although the DNC official declined to comment on the timing of the sponsorship withdrawal, but said that it stands in solidarity with women. The DNC stands in solidarity with all those fighting for women's rights, holding the Trump administration, Republican lawmakers around the country accountable. Women are on the front lines of fighting back, blah, 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 blah. So here's what really happened. Last year, this was out. Last year, we knew these things were going on.
We didn't really know the extent of it, and we have a kind of a deep dive going into this on, what day is today?
It's Wednesday. It's tomorrow.
So tomorrow's show.
Tomorrow.
On the Women's March and the history of it, when it comes to anti-Semitism, which goes back to literally the formational meeting.
Mm-hmm. But
when they were actually together for the first time discussing the idea of the Women's March,
mm-hmm.
they were talking about the problems with Jews. That is how deep this goes.
The problem with the Jews. This goes back to my advice that I gave to Republicans back in about 2009. I said, you have to be really careful who you're standing with, because there's going to be a lot of people that you're standing with that will agree with a lot of the stuff you agree with, but you're going to disagree with them on some pretty big fundamental issues. Don't be hijacked. So all these women, they were upset about Donald Trump, or they were upset about, you know, a Republican victory or whatever it was. Some of them valid reasons. Some of them anti-Semite, anti-white, yada, yada, yada. You all came together. It's like, look at how the right has split apart as soon as there's power. The right splits apart because it's easier to come together when you're against something. But when you actually have to state you're for something, you got to get down to specifics. And you're like, okay, well, wait a minute, I'm not for that. And then it starts to break apart somewhat. You have to know that you have the same principles. The DNC says they're standing in solidarity with those fighting for women's rights. Well, you should probably get a little more specific. This is what really happened. This had nothing to do with The View. Other sponsors have not returned to this year's march, including the Southern Poverty Law Center. When you don't have the Southern Poverty Law, when the Southern Poverty Law Center says, you know what, this group on the left is a little extreme, that's saying something. They don't have Emily's List, the Human Rights Campaign. They don't have NARAL. They don't have the Center for American Progress or Amnesty International standing with them anymore. If you're going to the Women's March this weekend, you're in a rapidly diminishing circle of people. And you're kind of being left with some radicals. The outlet reported fewer than half of the sponsors in 2018 have returned to support 2019. This thing is over. And it's not like the Tea Party. The Tea Party didn't implode. This is imploding.
I mean, it's over. If the Democratic Party is bailing on it, it's no longer of use.
It's right? Over.
The only use of it in the first place, it had never... I shouldn't say it never had anything to do with women's rights, because the first, you know, the actual founder of not the march, but the movement, who just did it on Facebook, right? Like, it wasn't. She seems to be someone who...
She's been saying for a while, you got to get these people out of there.
She bailed out of the entire organization because she knew these people were bad and what they were doing. And they wouldn't denounce Louis Farrakhan. I mean, this is not a high hurdle to clear here. We're not asking you for a really nuanced person to try.
You got to distance yourself from Nancy Pelosi. No, this is Louis Farrakhan.
This is Louis Farrakhan. And again, it's not just saying, well, I went to an event and he was there, and I'm not going to trash the guy. We were at the same event. This is, I'm calling him the greatest of all time for what he's done in the black community, which is what exactly? Convince them that Jews are bad? What exactly
and
has he done?
Whites are bad?
White people?
Whites are the devil?
What has he done? He's done nothing except inject poison into an entire community for multiple decades.
So this is what's going to happen to the Democratic Party if they're not careful. The Democratic Party has become so extreme that they are going to chase off all normal people. Now, they've hit it pretty well. These guys have been, you know, behind the scenes for a while. All the people we talked about while we were at Fox, all those people, they've all been hidden. They've all been washed. Even the people that we thought were very dangerous at the time, those people are not radical enough. And those people are on the outs. They are eating their own, and it is becoming a very vicious circle of people. Very vicious. And you're seeing it. And if the Democratic Party is not careful, look at what Mayor Cuomo or Governor Cuomo is doing. Right now, the press is talking about how crazy extreme Donald Trump is for saying that he wants law and order and a border wall. Now, we have more people coming from Honduras. I don't know if you heard this. Another caravan is coming up from Honduras now. 800 people in this one. They're saying that they're hoping that the president will change his mind by the time they get here. He's not, guys. He's not going to change his mind. You're not coming into the United States. It's immoral. And whoever is telling you that you're going to be able to get in, they're lying to you. They're lying to you. So they're coming up from Honduras again, yet another caravan. He is being called immoral for saying, we have to be clear. This is a humanitarian crisis. It'll only get worse. We have to be clear. You're not coming in. And we need a wall to make sure that they understand we're serious about this. That's immoral. But what Governor Cuomo is doing, Governor Cuomo says he will not sign another budget until full abortion rights are passed in New York. Now, that means full abortion rights means you have a right to an abortion for any reason at any time up until birth. Excuse me? How is that not immoral? How is that not? How dare you take the state hostage? You won't pass a budget until you can have a partial birth abortion? Do you realize how out of the, on the edge and in space and on the fringe that is?
Somebody really doesn't like attending baby showers. I think that's the, does not want to show up.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program. This is the Glenn Beck program, and we welcome a member of Parliament, Daniel Hannan. Daniel, thank you for being on the program today.
It's a great pleasure, Beck. Always nice to be with you.
You bet. We know how busy you are. Can you please explain to America, if you can, what this means? It appears to us on this side of the water that you're kind of going through the same thing we've been going through, where the politicians are just not listening to the people. And they're going their own way, and Theresa May has paid a heavy price for it. What's happening?
Yeah, I think you put it very well. When the Parliament voted to allow people a referendum on whether to leave the European Union, it never occurred to MPs that the voters might disregard their advice and vote leave. And what has happened in the last 2.5 years since the vote is basically that our political class, not only our MPs, but to be fair, you know, the chiefs of the big rent-seeking corporates, a lot of the civil service, a lot of what Americans would call the deep state, you know, our permanent bureaucracy, diplomats and, charities and think tanks and the whole establishment have refused to accept the result. And although it looks like chaos, it actually has a very simple cause, which is basically the politicians and their allies in the political elites are not doing what the country instructed them to.
So, Daniel, we are going through the same thing with the border. Europe is going through this throughout, and it is going to cause chaos if politicians don't start listening to the people. Is there a chance that that's going to happen now?
I mean, you'd have thought that a referendum would be the classic case of where politicians have no option but to listen, right? Because that's what a referendum is. And yet, as I say, it never really occurred to them to plan for a leave vote. And so what we've had, there have been some who have right from the beginning just tried to overturn the result or disregard it. Now, I know that that sounds funny, but if you think about it, it's not uncommon practice in the EU. You know, whenever they get a result that they don't like in a referendum, they try and rerun it or disregard it. They did it in Denmark. They did it in Ireland. They did it in France, Netherlands. So, you know, they treat public opinion as an obstacle to get around, not as a source of instruction.
And that's why there's unrest in the streets.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but there is a mood of unpleasantness and incivility in our discourse, rather like in the U.S. But for us, it's really new. I've never known.
I meant in Europe
years ago, people to fall out.
Yeah. I meant in Europe.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. That is certainly the case, and from a similar cause, you know. But the funny thing is, the politicians who've been so determined to try and frustrate Brexit, what they've done is they've coalesced around this idea of we mustn't leave without a deal. And this, of course, has encouraged the Brussels side, when they were told that Britain wasn't going to walk away. Well, what would you do in a negotiation, right? Imagine you were buying a house or something, or selling a house, and the other party says, I want you to know that I'm never going to walk away. I'm definitely going to sign something. What would you do, right? The EU has has taken advantage of this weakness to insist on really quite vindictive terms. And the funny thing is, they may have overplayed their hand, which means that there is now quite a strong likelihood that Britain will leave on the 29th of March without there being any deal at all.
Is that a good thing?
Well, it's not where I would have wanted to start, but given where we now are, I think leaving with no deal whatever is far better than signing up to these vengeful terms that the European side has set. And you know what? Life is going to carry on. You know, people will still open their shops and the traffic lights will still work.
Right.
And an awful lot of people who have been predicting economic catastrophe are going to be left looking very silly indeed.
So, Daniel, Corbyn from, again, across the water and not paying attention to your politics, he doesn't seem like a good dude. he seems anti-Semitic. He's a socialist at best. What's happening with him? Is he going to get into the mix here and possible next prime minister?
Well, it's a scary thought. I mean, here's the thing, Glenn.
So we're reading this right about him?
Well, do you know, it's not often that anyone accuses you of this, Glenn, but I think you have understated the situation. It's a common thing in politics that we use strong language, we use strong words, and we can devalue it. And then when you're left with the genuine article, it's difficult. You've almost run out of vocabulary.
Yeah.
But let me put it like this. Here is, for the first time in British history, a party leader who was on the other side during the Cold War, who regrets the outcome of the Cold War. He has never seen a communist dictatorship that he hasn't defended. Chavez, Castro, the Soviet Union, he's pro-Hamas, he's pro-Hezbollah, he was pro-IRA. In fact, there has never been a quarrel that has involved the UK where he hasn't taken the other side, even when we were fighting the Falklands War against a fascist dictatorship in Argentina, right? A fascist dictatorship that disappeared, as they said, leftist agitators and trade unionists that threw people out of planes and so on. He still couldn't bring himself to back Britain. This is the guy that 2 out of 5 Brits voted for at the last election, which is a truly terrifying thought. Now, of course, normally in a mature democracy like ours, you would say, well, if someone like that has got no prospect of getting in. I mean, he makes Bernie Sanders look like a Republican. There's no chance that anyone would vote for someone like him. But if there is sufficient anger at the way in which the government fails to deliver the Brexit vote, then anything is possible.
What do the people of Great Britain want you to do right now? What should we be praying for that you guys do that will make sure that it doesn't get more radical and unstable?
You know, I think the best outcome now is that Brexit is delivered, that we become an independent country with its own trade policy, that we move right away to a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with you guys, our strongest allies and our biggest trading partners, and we're also your biggest investors, you're our biggest investors. That will be a big part of it. I think that will very quickly be followed by a resumption of amicable relations with our European neighbors. You know, once this Brexit process is complete, I think we'll very quickly get round the table and become allies again. And I think there will then be a restoration of something resembling normal politics in the UK.
What about Ireland? Doesn't that cause a problem with the borders with Ireland and all that stuff, or is that just nonsense?
I'm afraid it is just nonsense. And actually, this will become very clear in the event that we leave without a deal, because we will leave without a deal, and it will then be obvious that there is no physical border in Ireland and that there was never going to be. The whole thing has been cooked up as a way of trying to keep Britain within the EU's trade policy, to allow Brussels to continue to dictate whom we trade with and on what terms. And, you know, the short answer when somebody starts saying, oh, but what about a hard border in Ireland? Just ask that person, who's going to erect this border? I mean, which government is going to send, you know, construction workers to the frontier and tell them to start putting up physical infrastructure? It's just not going to happen. Neither London nor Dublin nor Brussels wants it, whether or not there is a deal.
One last question. Does this, if England exits, Does this start a domino effect in Europe?
Well, if it exits and succeeds, which of course is one of the reasons why Brussels is being so obstreperous and aggressive in the negotiations, right? I mean, if any other country, if Canada or Japan or somewhere were offering the kind of trade terms and close continuing cooperation that Britain was doing, the EU would bite their hand off. They'd say, quick, you know, get them to agree to that before the idiots come to their senses. But they, you know, there are a number of people in the European Commission in Brussels, not so much, I have to say, in the national capitals, not in Warsaw or Rome or Berlin or Madrid, but in Brussels, there are a lot of people who would rather see all sides suffer than watch a post-EU Britain succeed.
Wow. Daniel, thank you so much. We pray for you, and we pray for our brothers and sisters across the ocean, and we wish you the best of luck. God bless.
Thank you, my friend. You all bet. The best to you.
You bet. Daniel Hannan. That concerns me. What he just said really concerns me. And we have to make time today to talk about that. I know we're out of time.
They want to see it fail?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With what's happening in the with the euro, what's happening with the banking system, this is just it's all coming together. You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
I want to set this up just in case. Do we know, Sarah, what the odds are? I mean, are we having transmission? Are we not getting a connection? What do you know what's happening? Connection is not happening yet.
The tough one. I mean, we're talking about a phone call into Russia from someone who's hiding their identity.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, who knows what's going to happen with this
I know.
Thing.
So let me just set it up in case we get the connection, because I don't want to get the connection and then not go to it. And I want you prepared for this interview. This is somebody who is part of the LGBT community in Russia. If you remember right, about 5 years ago, I talked to you about the real plight of homosexuals in the former Soviet Union. Putin was starting to take away driver's license. People, if you were homosexual, you started to lose rights. In Chechnya, I told you that they were starting to scoop people up off the street. And this was 5 years ago, and we didn't have confirmation of it. We just had words. Now there is the LGBT community in Russia who are, these people are extraordinarily brave. Remember, you're screwing with the Chechens and Putin, and they are trying to reach out and say, hey, we have to tell the world what's going on. Now, we could be like the world was in, you know, 1939 and go, oh, well, it's just a bunch of crazy Jews. The Germans would never do that. Or we could actually say, these people are risking their life to get this information out. And they're Russians. What they're saying is that people are being taken off the street by the Russian government. They are targeted because they are gay. About 150 people have already been smuggled out of the area. One guy said, I was kidnapped and kept for 12 days in a basement. They put a plastic bag over my head and put a gun to my head. I was interrogated, physically abused, and forced to contact a person that I was dating. They made me call another guy and tell him to come into a car where they kidnapped him as well. Another person from Chechnya said that the Russian government in Chechnya electrocuted my friends, beat them, denied them food and water. My plea to you in this audience is that we will put aside feelings that we might have about agendas. And I would say that not just to you, I would say that mainly to places like GLAAD. I don't agree with GLAAD, but if they will stand against this, I will gladly stand with them. We need to pay attention. We have the connection now in Russia. How do I even address you? Can I call you by your name or assumed name?
Well, hello. Let's call me just a contact.
Okay, contact. And you're a member of the LGBT network in Russia.
Yes, that's right.
Can you tell us what's happening in Chechnya?
Well, the thing with Chechnya, it's really difficult to say what exactly is going on there. Because of the small NGO, we don't have access there. But what do we know from our sources is there at least 40 people were detained within less than a month, and at least 2 people were killed. Basically, they were tortured to death. And it all happened.
Wait. Hold on just a sec. Could you speak a little slower? We have, I got 40 people have been taken, and 2 people have been tortured to death. You'll just speak a little slower.
Okay, what do we know? Shall I start from the very beginning?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. We're live, by the way, so go ahead.
Oh, so basically we know that 40 people were killed and at least 2 people were tortured to death. And the Russian authorities, they still deny even the fact that LGBT people exist in Russia. They don't just deny the fact that they're tortured or persecuted.
So is Putin, or is this Chechnyan, or is this the Russian government and the Chechnyans?
Basically, all what's going on, it's like all the people are persecuted by the local law enforcement agencies, by the local Chechen police, and both Russian authorities at all levels, they say that nothing is going on at all levels. Chechen authorities say so, and Russian federal authorities say so, too.
And if I'm not mistaken, Russia and Putin in particular is not friendly to the gay and lesbian agenda at all.
Well, I believe that it's widely known that Russia is a very homophobic country.
And they have, I know it was proposed, did they end up taking driver's license away from gay and lesbians? Known gay and lesbians.
No.
They did not.
Well, basically, no. They don't do like anything like that, no.
Okay.
What we have is the so-called law, propaganda law. And according to this law, it's prohibited to propagate homosexuality among minors. But it's not defined what propaganda means. So the court decides on their own what does it mean. And quite often people are accused for very like simple things.
And how is word getting out of Chechnya about this? What's going on? How reliable is this information?
Well, we first learned about what's going on there in the very end of December, and we didn't know if it was true or not. So we tried to verify everything. So that's why information basically from us appeared only this week. We have our own sources, of course. We work with human rights defenders and with people in Chechnya, and we already evacuated more than like around 150 people from there. And all these people, they have their own contacts. So we try, you know, to check from all the sides. It's really hard to say what's going on in Chechnya right now, and are people are still in prison, and how many people are killed, and what's going on. But I believe that information we provided about 40 people detained and 2 killed is reliable.
Tell me what you are afraid of personally, because you're not in Chechnya. So why? What are you afraid of?
Well, you know, we have cases when people who were taken out of Chechnya by us, who were evacuated and put into shelters, were attacked and basically were kidnapped. And in Russia, we have cases when human rights defenders and journalists who work with Chechen issues were killed. So I believe that, like, we with the Russian LGBT network have all the reasons to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. First, for our own safety, and second, to be able to continue with our work, to continue to support those who are in Chechnya.
I have to ask you a tough question here. America is skeptical, to say the least, about Russia right now and Vladimir Putin, interference and, you know, disinformation, et cetera, et cetera. And we can argue it goes both ways, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where America is right now. What would you say to people who would say, well, am I being played by a Russian to help Putin make Chechnya into a bad place that he could go in and be an iron fist?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm not a politician. I'm a human rights defender. I'm really not into politics right now. And when I talk about Chechnya and about people who are being killed and tortured, I talk about people's lives. And they talk about people's destinies. And what I can say to Americans who are probably listening right now is, like, I truly believe that what stopped the first wave of persecution is international attention. And I would like basically to ask for more attention mm-hmm. from Americans. And I believe that it is something that can help many lives, can save many lives.
Well, I will tell you that... this is a very conservative audience, and one that, you know, stereotypical in America would say, oh, they've got a problem with gays or whatever. And we don't. I, for one, will make sure that my audience knows about this. I hope that the LGBT networks here in America will start talking about this, take this seriously, and stand with people like me and my audience to save the lives of people who are being killed just because of their lifestyle. This is obscene and violates every kind of human right that that you can imagine. So I thank you for your bravery. I wish I knew your name just so I could write it in my diary for my children to listen to and to read about someday, about courageous people. But I think you are extraordinarily brave, and our prayers and our best go to not only you, but everyone in your network.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program, and we really want to thank you for listening. This salad nonsense is driving me out of my mind. The media is now coming out and saying, oh, Donald Trump, was he being a misogynist by saying the first lady and second lady would make a salad? Yeah, that's exactly what he was doing. Yeah, you know, guys, I got the little fillies. I told them to go in the kitchen to make you a salad. Has anyone ever thought that maybe the first lady and the second lady might go, I don't know, Dad, I mean, we just go into the kitchen, we could make a salad. First of all, he's not making salads. He's not making a salad for himself. He's not making food himself. He's lived the life of Donald Trump forever. He's the kind of guy, if he wants something, he'll send somebody out to McDonald's, and that's what he eats. Can we stop with this nonsense?
Tad concerned why the first lady would say dad to Donald Trump.
No, the second lady said that.
Well, the second lady is Mike Pence's wife, isn't it?
Oh, I guess it is. I was thinking he was talking about his daughter, Ivanka. Yeah. This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program. And don't forget, rate us on iTunes. Mr. Matt Kibbe was a guy who helped start FreedomWorks and then left FreedomWorks. You were instrumental in the Tea Party. And then you kind of branched out, went out on your own, and tried to find a way to make politics meaningful and actually get something done, because nothing's working right now.
Yeah, that could be a contradiction, right?
Yeah, I know. How are you, Matt?
I am doing great.
Good. Should we start with the announcement?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, go ahead.
So as of today, and this was carefully planned for years in advance, not really, it just sort of happened. I am officially a member of the Blaze TV family, and I will be launching my new show, Kibbe on Liberty, imminently. And it's going to be different than anything I've ever done before. And it goes to directly to what we're talking about. You know, if the Tea Party was a cadre of everybody that shared a set of values and we're going to come together and try to impact politics at the margin, I feel like technology is enabling us to reach a lot of new people. I call them the Liberty Curious. There's people out there that are trying to figure out where they fit in this hyper partisan world. And I don't feel like enough people are even trying to talk to them. So we're going to try to do that.
Really, who is in either party per se? Who is? I mean, Stu and I talked about this just the other day. What would it take for you to get back and say, you know what? I'm a registered Republican. Nothing. 5 years of absolute consistent voting patterns and standing up for the Constitution. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I mean, I think more and more people are like, I don't have a home in either of these parties.
And part of it, like it's how young people think about the world. And part of this is very much fueled by technology. They live in this a la carte world where they get to choose everything. And they choose from millions of bands every day.
Right.
And yet when it comes to politics, somebody they don't know decided you get this choice or that choice. And they're like, I don't even understand. Well, that's
right.
What is that?
Right. And I think that's the problem. I think this has kind of been bubbling in my head recently, that the problem is that we are so a la carte on everything else, except for politics, that when it comes to something like the border, look, here's what I want. I want security. I want to know who's in the country. I want to know that MS-13 is not getting across the border. So I don't care what it is. The wall is only a symbol of screw you, politicians. You've told us you care about this forever. I don't believe you. I want something permanent that you can't get around. It's more about the politicians than it is the people on the other side of the border, I feel.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think people on both sides of the aisle across the spectrum have come to this very uncomfortable realization that, you know what, government's been lying to us.
Uh-huh.
And this is also fueled by technology. People know more. And all those politicians who used to say one thing at home and then come to Washington and do the opposite, now you can sort of find out that they were lying to you all along. So I view it as a paradigm shift. Like people are raging against the machine. It's happening all over the world.
And all
this vacillation from far left to far right and all that stuff. It's just people trying to figure out how to rein this thing in. And, you know, they only have so many tools available to them, so they do what they can. But these symbols, these symbolic fights, you know, is Trump going to let the machine beat him? I think they might have met their match.
I do too.
I think Trump may be just stubborn enough to do what lots of politicians have promised. You know, I'm a veteran of several shutdowns, the 1994, 96 shutdown, and then of course the Tea Party shutdown. And I still believe to this day that the good guys, if they'd stuck with it, would have had a tremendously big impact.
He's going to stick with it. And I think this is doing tremendous good and bad at the same time. Tremendous good is it's showing us we don't really need it.
Right.
We don't need it. We don't need, oh, wow, you can't go to work. Good. You know what I mean? With an exception of a few things, nothing's really unraveling.
Right.
Except for the media and the political elite. You know, again, there are certain exceptions to this. It's good in that way because it's teaching Americans, you know, they're not as important in your life as they try to make you believe they are. The second thing is, it could get to the point to where it discredits government so much that you have more of this attitude of, it's all bad.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think both things are happening. And, you know, I didn't actually know until the other day that there's a guy in the government who's been furloughed who approves beer labels.
Excuse me?
Beer labels. And I'm like, why is the government doing that? One of the things you could learn out of this process is that so many government functions should have never been there in the first place.
What is this? Wait.
Yeah, we've talked about this. This is craft beers.
Yeah. Oh, the craft beers guy.
Yeah.
Okay, but why?
What? The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, right, Matt?
You're right.
And I think this is the one thing that people might revolt against the government shutdown, because if they're not getting their new flavors
the tipping
of beer.
Point. Yeah,
it really is.
I've thought about switching teams over this issue. Yeah.
Go Kamala Harris!
Yeah. Although I don't think she cares about my beer freedom either.
No,
to be
she
honest
doesn't.
With you.
Of course.
So Matt, when you see things like Brexit, and you see the European Union that does not have a constitution, does not have a freedom understanding, and you see this undertow of politicians just being bad. What does that tell you? What's coming?
Well, it's the Empire Strikes Back, and it's all of us learning across the globe that there is this permanent bureaucracy. It's a business. Big government is a business, and they don't care about you. They care about themselves. It's and I'm not saying that as some sort of cynical, paranoid thing. That's just, it's how it works. People in government are just as self-interested as the rest of us, and if you give them all that power, they're going to take care of themselves. Not the rest of us. But I happen to be an optimist about this process, because I think we're in the middle of learning what government is really about. And because of technology, we see again and again and again that they take care of themselves instead of doing the things that they said they were going to do. But it's pretty scary. And you see this, it's more vivid in Europe than it is in this country. And you've talked about this all the time. You see the neo-fascists, you see the neo-Marxists, and you could get this vacillation from radical right-wing populism to radical left-wing populism because nobody trusts the process anymore. But that's where we step in, and we got to fill that void with things that we should have been doing more of. And I know you did it every day. But during the Tea Party movement, we needed to spend more time on educating. You know, why is limiting executive power so important? And why does it matter not just now, but 50 years from now? And we need to sort of fill in those blanks for all of these new eyeballs, these new minds that are trying to figure out how the world works.
You've been so good at that. I mean, I watch your stuff on socialism and everything else. You've been so good at teaching, and teaching in a different way, teaching to an audience that is not necessarily my audience, and yet we have so much in common. But you're teaching the people who are like, wait a minute, none of this makes sense, none of this works. Nobody's teaching that at all.
And you know, how is it that free people manage to solve problems without a TSA, without someone approving our beer labels? We live in this world where almost everything we do is free, and we sort of take it for granted that things work when we're left alone to do that kind of stuff. But you know, we've been told that unless the government has a program, that's not going to get done. But you got to unveil some of those stories about people helping people and solving problems, and no one told them to do it, and there wasn't an appropriation. There wasn't a regulation. It's just what free people do.
You're seeing, you go over to the old former Eastern Bloc, just the fringe countries, Poland, Hungary, et cetera, and they are starving and on fire. I think that is the new American alliance. Those countries are not going to go the way of Russia or Europe if it starts to go ugly. Do you believe that?
I believe that, but there's a reason I spend time over there, is because I want to make sure that, you know, the solution is going to be freedom-based and not power-based. Because the thing that's being offered to young people today, which they're rejecting mostly, is, you know, everything's about power, and you can either be a Marxist or a Nazi. And nobody wants to be a Nazi, so do I have to be a Marxist?
Mm-hmm.
That's a false choice. It's an obscene choice. And And weirdly, if you accept that left-right thing, which I don't really do, in the middle are all the people that are like, I just want to be left alone, and I want an opportunity to work and,
right.
and create value.
And I don't want people starving to death. I want to be just a decent person, and can't we just be left alone?
Yeah.
But that's not what's happening. I'm going to take a quick break, and let me talk to you about the new drinking water tax in California. How extreme Cuomo is getting on his refusal to sign the budget unless you have access to abortion even in the last hour of your pregnancy, and how the left is going more and more extreme and I think eating itself. But this is the best of the Glenn Beck program. I hate the fact that I'm going to do this interview, or that I have to do this interview, that I think this interview is important. Laura Wilkerson is, she's a wife and a mom. She and her husband owned a plumbing shop. It's a suburb of Houston in Pearland, Texas. And her son, her youngest son, 18 at the time, was brutally murdered, tortured to death by an illegal. And we have her on the phone to talk about the border wall. Laura, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I do not want to put you in... I can't imagine what your life is like and having to talk about this all the time. So I'm going to... You tell the story in any way that you feel comfortable telling the story.
Certainly. We did. We have three children, and Josh was our youngest son, and he was 18, a senior in high school. And we sent him to school one day, and apparently during that day, a classmate asked for a ride home from Josh, and Josh said yes and gave it to him. And Josh never came home that day, and so I knew immediately something was wrong. I guess it's mother's instinct, or, you know, Josh was always that kid of mine that I always knew where he was. So anyway, I went looking around town for him, and I... did not find him. I went by the police station to make sure there wasn't any, you know, accidents or something, and went by school to make sure he was there. And at any point, I found I was coming home to start really, you know, trying to see what I could do. And I looked over and saw his truck sitting in the back by a dumpster, kind of behind a strip center. And I went over there and looked at it, and I could tell something was wrong with it. So called my husband, called police, and they came down. And, shortly after that, they opened the dumpster and asked me to come over and, you know, see if these were Joshua's things. And they were. It was his shoes and his backpack and all the stuff that had come out of, you know, his truck. And so we stood there in that parking lot for hours. You know, I was wondering if Josh was in there. And finally, they sent us home and they took his truck as, you know, as evidence and made it a crime scene and then sent us home to wait. And that morning, about 3 a.m, they came back and said they had a suspect in custody and that they wanted us, we're going to look for him all the next day. So we spent the next day, whole day looking for him. And finally he gave up where he had put Joshua's body and, told where it was. And so they found him. He was brought here from Belize by his parents when he was 10. And we found out at trial that, you know, he just overstayed, I guess, his visa. But when we finally 2 years to bring him to trial, first he was incompetent, so we had to send him away and force medicine on him. And then we brought him back, jury trial, he's competent. And then we went straight to the criminal trial. And at that point, the killer got on the stand and told us exactly how he murdered Josh. And he said, you know, I first kneed him so hard in the stomach, and when he did it, it sliced Joshua's spleen. And next he took a closet rod and beat him in the head with it until the rod broke in 4 pieces. And he told us that Josh kept trying to get up off the ground and he didn't want him to, so he strangled him, and he said, you know, bloody bubbles were coming out of his nose. And, you know, as a mother, you sit there and you hear that and you think, you know, he's struggling to breathe and grasping. And then he strangled him over and over until death. And then he tied him up with 13 loops of rope around his neck and to his hands and feet bound behind his back. And he put him in our truck, and he drove around town and bought $2 worth of gasoline. And then he set him in a field, and he put his ID and wallet, you know, 8 or 10 feet away from the body, I guess wanting someone to know who he was. And then he set him on fire after death.
I'm sorry, Laura. I can't imagine. My daughter went into the hospital. I have one daughter today in the hospital for looking at brain surgery, and I have another daughter who was in the hospital for something else this weekend. And I can't imagine losing my children natural causes. I don't know how you deal with it. You lived in Houston for a while, and this was a guy. He was kind of a dreamer, wasn't he? I mean, he would have fallen under the Dream Act
description. I believe so. Yeah, he fit that dream kid description because he was brought here, I think, under the age of 16 is what I'm thinking it was. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, he was brought here young and then overstayed, I guess, what maybe he had a 6 month visa. You know, it's hard to find out for me to find out anything about him. Whereas if you're an American citizen, about 10 minutes, you're going to know everything about, you know, you or I. That's another part of the problem, you know. But that's as far as I know. Yes, he was brought here by his parents when he was 10 and then overstayed. When the police first went to his parents' home and said, you know, your son has killed, you know, this boy. And his father said, well, I have a ticket to Belize that I've had for 3 weeks and I'm using it. You know, he did not end up using that, but that was, you know, it wasn't about, what kid, what are you talking about? How could my kid ever, you know, it was none of that. It was, I have a ticket that I've had for 3 weeks and I'm going to use it.
For his son or for him?
For him.
Oh my gosh.
For him. And he just didn't. So that was his response.
Oh my gosh.
What are you talking about? My kid killed somebody. You know, what? It was just a response that I thought said everything it needed to say about him, you know, his parents even.
So, Laura, don't talk to the politicians. I don't care about the politicians. Just talk to a mom or a dad right now. I assume that you don't hate all immigrants and you don't hate, Hispanics or anything else. Talk to a parent on why the conversation that we're having right now is so important. And I mean, as a country, and why a border fence, a border wall is imperative.
Yes, it is imperative. You know, you and I can't explain really. There's not words to even explain to you the depth of the pain when something like this happens, when you lose a child in anything. But then you add the trauma and the violence and the knowledge that he shouldn't have been in this country in the first place. And you're absolutely, you die that day. You know, I died that day to who I was. And you have to, it's down too much as learning to breathe again and crawl again and walk again and stand up again. And it's a rebuilding of our lives that will take forever to do. And the pain, it's just a soul pain that it goes so deep you can't hardly even describe it. And we've got to have, you know, it's imperative to have the border because we have a right as American citizens to know who's in this country with us.
And he did he come across the border illegally? Did he make that trek across the border? Do you even know?
If I'm not mistaken, his parents had a 6-month visa for him.
Okay.
And it overstated. His
right. So it's
before he was.
It's not. And this is, I think, really important to point out. This isn't just about a border wall or a border fence. This is about fixing this problem, knowing who is here. We've known people are overstaying their visa since 9/11. That was the biggest problem. We haven't fixed that even. Doesn't seem like anybody cares about. And I don't mean to, because you know this isn't true, but it feels like no one cares about people like you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I do know it's not true. I mean, that's the only way I've made it through is that, you know, God has assured me that, you know, of where Josh is today and that he will get me through this. And that's the security that I have. But you're right. We have a right to know. I mean, I can't fly to Austin from Houston to Austin without a driver's license. And, you know, what it took to get that and what you have to maintain. You know, you can't have 1,000 tickets and have a driver's license. And, you know, you work to just follow the law. That's what you do as an American citizen. You do it or you don't get the privileges to drive, to fly, to, you know, those things. And I just don't understand why they would want to give it away in even leniency on those things to people that have already committed the crime of coming in this country or overstaying a visa.
Have you talked to President Trump?
I have. I've talked to him.
Have you talked to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer? Have they ever talked to you?
I was able to tell my story to Nancy Pelosi once.
In a hearing?
No, it was a town hall, and I happened to be in the audience, and her response to me was that she was sorry and that thanks for channeling my energy, but that everyone in her sanctuary city was a law-abiding citizen. That was her answer to me. But no. They know. I mean, they absolutely know what's happened and what's happening, but they just don't want you to think they know. You know, they want to seem oblivious to it, but everybody knows. I mean, so many more people have died than in 9/11, you know, from illegals in this country, that it's mind-boggling that's so easily forgotten, how just a couple, you know, 9 of them that got in and stayed a while and you know, hated America.
I tell you, I don't have anything like this in my life, but I have done enough homework and I scream at the television at people on both sides. And I can't imagine it being as personal as it is for you and how you just don't understand when this is all just common sense. All of this is common sense.
It's absolutely common sense. I just think, you know, you can't hardly get it across what it does to American families. You know, they're broken in so many ways, you know, of our own making, divorce and stuff. And this right here just devastates a family. It's absolutely the most devastating thing that I could ever imagine in being, you know, able to live. If there's anything this greater pain, you know, I don't think I'd live through it. You know, I can't imagine what's worse.
How's George, your husband?
He's doing well. You know, we're all learning to put life back together, and that comes with a lot of aggravation and overwhelmed, and you can't really do the job that you used to do. And, you know, it's just a mix of all of it. And you never know what you're going to get when you wake up, if it's going to be kind of an angry day or a sad day, and you just have to learn to live it.
I'm going to get yelled at by my producers who are always telling me I'm out of time, but can I just take a minute with you and just ask you this? Tell me who your son was.
Josh was just a really, really quiet, good kid. He'd never been in trouble. You know, he was learning what he wanted to do in life. He thought he might go in the Air Force like his brother, and he just was a good kid. He was very compassionate. You know, he died doing exactly what we taught him to do. I would never have told him not to give somebody a ride home. You know, he was the most compassionate, quiet kid, but he really had a close relationship with Jesus. You know, sometimes he would say things to me and I would just go, "Ooh," you know, I knew that came from Jesus to him and not from me. And he really, really was just a good kid. He, you know, very quiet. I think that's why people in this community were just so alarmed about it, because he didn't have an enemy that I can think of. He just didn't.
Laura, thank you Sorry to put you through that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
God bless. Laura Wilkerson, an angel mom. And you can visit the website, enforcethelaw.org. You want to know why we, the government, is closed? Because it's time we listen to people like that.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.